Welcome everyone to the Friends That Carry On podcast, where we dive deeper into our trips, unpack tips, and everything in between. Now sit back, relax, and get ready to go on a trip with your favourite group of friends.
Hello and welcome to this week's podcast of Friends That Carry On. We're excited to have someone in studio today to do an interview. Before we get to that, I want to go over how you can get to Friends That Carry On. Obviously, we're at www.friendsthatcarryon.com. We also can be reached at social medias, Facebook and Instagram at friendsthatcarryon.com, and our fledgling YouTube channel as well. So there's not a lot there yet, but we're hoping to get there. And I assume that's at friendsthatcarryon.com too, correct?
I believe so.
So today in the house, before we introduce our guest, we have the friends, starting with
Eric Fargo,
Brian Romine,
and Tony,
and I'm Jim Scott. And today we are excited to have in house a longtime friend, college fraternity brother, and now YouTube sensation, Bo Wimet, aka the Aqua Chigger. So, Bo, welcome to the podcast. I'm going to sort of let Eric take over from here, but before I do that, maybe tell us a little bit about you're a relic hunter extraordinaire, and why don't you sort of give us a little background on how you got into that?
Well, I don't think I'd actually say I'm like a relic hunter extraordinaire, but I have been relic hunting for many, many years, started probably 40 years ago, right here in Shepherdstown. I'm pretty good at relic hunting. I enjoy it, but I like to think of myself more of an explorer and a storyteller now with what I do with relic hunting and going out and in the outdoors and just doing things that I can share with other people. So, yeah, does that make sense?
No, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. That's awesome.
What a great
place
to get started in Shepherdstown, all the history.
Yeah, Shepherdstown is just loaded with history. I mean, we're right at the bottom of the Shenandoah Valley. Harpers Ferry is just down the road. The soldiers, Civil War history is just incredible. Colonial history. All kinds of stuff happened in Shepherdstown and in the surrounding area. Yeah, I was blessed, being here, growing up in this area, and having the opportunity to really hone my skills.
Did this area had an impact in kind of creating the excitement that kept you doing what you've been doing for so long?
I think so, yeah, especially with the metal detecting side of it, because there was so much to be found here. And that really keeps you going when you do well. I've been to many parts of the country where you just don't really find a lot of stuff. I mean, you find things, but not, really cool old things. So I think this area really kind of rooted me and really let me develop that love for searching for history, artifacts and telling a story.
Very cool.
That's cool.
All right. Well, Eric, you want to take it away there, man?
Well, I'm going to ask the $64,000 question that you get asked 64,000 times, right? Where did the name Aqua Chigger come from?
This is such a, it's an easy question, but it takes me forever to answer it.
Okay.
Okay. Aqua Chigger, aqua water chigger. A chigger is a little insect that is on land, okay, and you walk through the tall grass and it gets on you and it bites you and it makes you itch. One day I was in a pond searching for artifacts, and when I came out of the pond, I was covered with these welts, and it's a type of insect that lives in the water. I can't remember the name, but it's called duckworms or something like that. And swimmers itch, you can get it in salt water, you can get it anywhere. So anyway, I come out of the water, I'm covered with these welts, and it itches like crazy for days. And I was trying to explain this to a friend of mine, Dan, and it was taking me forever. And he kind of cut me off and said, "Oh, you mean like, let me back up a second." I was trying to tell him how they felt and looked like chigger bites.
Mm-hmm.
And so he basically just said, "Oh, like aqua chiggers." Mm. And that was a word I've never heard before.
Boom, boom, light
yeah,
went off.
Exactly. Right. It was a unique word. Mm-hmm. So I just kind of went with it. and people started calling me Aqua Chigger. But like I said, it was a long story to get to the, I get bit in the water and chiggers.
That's a chigger. Great story.
I love
that's
it.
It's a much cooler sounding name than duckworms.
I've been called worse.
I wonder if duckworms would have as big a YouTube channel as you do, right?
I like it. Yeah, duckworm.
Duckworms.
Like
well, you may want to grab that URL, duckworms.com. Right.
Now, how far, because I know... and just knowing you from college, and I knew, you were into the outdoor stuff, fishing, exploring caves, all that type of stuff, and then got obviously were either already in the metal detector and got into it. But at what point did the Aqua Chigger nickname come? Were you still just doing it for fun or whatever, or had you actually started the YouTube channel and then that came at the same time, or that was just an old nickname and, hey, this is a catchy thing to use?
I think it probably started just about the time I started YouTube, which was 10, 12 years ago. I mean, I was posting online in a lot of the forums, relic forums and whatnot, and there are pictures out there. I actually took pictures of myself with these Aqua Chiggers, but I don't know if I was actually on YouTube yet.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
My mother's from Arkansas, so I know what a chigger is.
I mean, chigger, they're everywhere, and they're here. I mean, you can go out along the river, and, during the summer, and when you get back home, all of a sudden you realize that around, especially like where your clothes are tight around your belt and stuff, mm-hmm. I mean, they just tear you
out. Okay, we're going to have to move on. Like I'm crazy. Starting to get itchy.
or the Carolinas, or I remember.
They're everywhere.
Yeah.
They're everywhere. They're everywhere. They're everywhere.
They're not in here.
They're not in here.
At the moment.
I brought some with me.
So why videos? Why what made you go to video? What made you want to video it in the first place?
That's a great question. I was very active in the online forums. I was saying earlier, the relic hunting forums and whatnot. But there was a lot of problems with the moderators who... we're not very, it's hard to, it was not a friendly place. It became, a lot of the forums at the time, 10 years ago, they became somewhat unfriendly. If you were not in the cliques, in a clique that, with the moderators, it was fun for a while, but it became not fun. Mm-hmm. I had no control over what people would, what people said, and it was just very frustrating. And I discovered with YouTube, I actually found the camera that I started with in the river in Shepherdstown. Believe it or not.
I think that was mine.
Well, obviously the Potomac, right?
It was just downriver from here. And I picked it up and I just, started doing some video. Very, very, that was terrible. So I posted that to YouTube and I kind of discovered that I had full control over everything. If someone was being a jerk, you can get rid of them on YouTube. They don't.
Which was my next question: why YouTube?
Exactly. And then I have, as a YouTuber, you have full control over your channel. You can let it go wild if you want to let it go wild, or you can keep it family friendly, which I do with mine.
Oh, well, I have pretty wild.
No, I don't. Trust me, when the camera's not on, it gets wild. Okay, but I try to keep it very family friendly because the kids, for some reason, love me.
Right.
If I see that everywhere I go, it's always little kids.
Well, you're a history professor.
I don't know. I'll be driving down the road, down in the Carolinas, and all of a sudden I'll look over and there'll be like a car beside me, and these kids are screaming out the windows at me, waving.
Totally get
it. They just recognize me. Of course, I drive kind of a truck that, I've shown on my videos, and it's very kind of unique. So I try to keep it family friendly. I have a complete control on YouTube. You can block people on YouTube where they don't even know they're blocked. So they're making these nasty comments to you, to other people, trying to destroy the community that you're trying to build on YouTube, and they don't even know they're blocked.
Trying to tell you how to do your job.
Well, not so much that. I mean, I can take that. Right. You know, I don't have a problem with that, but, you know, trolls are trolls, right. And they just want you to get mad and lose control.
So you have quite a following. How do you manage, you know, kind of combing through that and finding the individuals that might be making those negative comments? That, I mean, that's a lot, well, it seems.
It is. I mean, I have, you know, 1,200 videos. It feels like 12,000.
Couple of zeros.
Kind of a joke.
That's Fargo
yeah,
math.
I have 1,200 videos, and people are commenting on those all the time, okay? But YouTube has, there is set up so that you can put in keywords that will filter the comments. So all the cuss words I can think of are filtered. All the derivations of the way they spell cuss words are filtered, which is good because you can keep the channel family friendly, but it's bad because those are really the only comments I get to see, you know, because it gets filtered. I look at it, you know, do I let it go or do I delete it? So I get stuck reading mostly those comments. You know, when I post a video, and I post videos almost every night, I try to, you know, stick around and answer questions, you know, for people for an hour or two. But it's really impossible to really closely monitor the channel other than using those keywords. But, you know, I do the best I can, and I can filter out a lot of that stuff. And YouTube has really gotten good with figuring out comments that are disruptive, even if they're not using cuss words and stuff like that. I don't know how they're doing it, but they're getting filtered, and I have to, you know, approve them or, you know, delete them. But it keeps, you know, I'm able to keep a fairly, are you there?
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. Fairly, you know, family-friendly environment, and that's my goal with my channel.
Yeah. Yeah. Nice. And back to the kids part and why, mm-hmm. you know, the kids are drawn to you. My kids love it, you know, the treasure hunting aspect of it, you know, the discovery. I can remember being a kid and having the cheap, you know, $3 metal detector out on the beach, and, you know, it was just exciting, the thrill of maybe finding something. And even if you dig up a little tiny piece of metal from an old Coca-Cola can, it was just the excitement of digging it up. So I can totally get that.
Yeah, and I, you know, that's the way I am. I can remember being a kid too, and be, you know, going looking for eggs from the chickens in the barn. I mean, it was like the most fantastic thing to look for these eggs, you know, and it was so exciting. And then, you know, I could barely walk at the time. You know, I was that young. But yeah, kids love that. And, you know, I'm trying to attract the kids into being excited about that, getting outside and enjoying the outdoors, but also the adults, because there's so many adults who have never been exposed to the outdoors. I mean, when I'm making these videos, I'm thinking that everyone knows what an oak tree is and why there's galls on the oak tree, you know, but so many people don't. They don't have a clue, and they want to learn. They want to know about these things, but not maybe in a classroom setting. So I'm always trying to throw out little, you know, little bits and pieces of knowledge that I have, and I don't have a lot, but I have some, and so that, you know, I think it's good for the children, but it's also good for the adults, you know, because, you know, a lot of people live in the city and they just don't know what trees are, you know.
Well, it sure has made me look at the way the lay of the land differently just by watching you. You know, you see something, a bump in the ground, you never pay attention to it until you're taught to, you know what I mean, which I've kind of learned from you what was there at one point, you know, what's under there, why did that get there, where's that, why is that rock there, that looks out of place.
It's kind of funny because I had something happen just a couple of days ago that was kind of like that, where I was out detecting with a friend of mine, and we were exploring. It was kind of a mountainous area, and I came upon this, well, it was clearly an old graveyard, and most of the stones were either knocked over, but they're small, just little field stones sticking up. But I could see a pattern in these stones, and I knew immediately it was a colonial era graveyard. I mean, you know, my buddy's there, and he's like, you know, he didn't see it. He didn't, you know, he didn't know, he didn't pick up on the clues. So it was good that I was able to not only teach him there, but I did a video on that too. Well, you know, what kind? You know, this is out of place. That one stone that's sticking up like that shouldn't be like that. Someone did that. You know, why is it there? We start looking, and there's tons of little, there's 20 stones there, at least 20 graves, and you can see the depressions,
mm-hmm.
You know, where people were buried. Right. And it's colonial era
and
stuff.
And where was
know,
this
1800.
Again?
That was in near Gore, Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Neat.
Yeah, Patsy Cline's house, one of her houses, did a video on that. Yeah, it's coming up.
Yeah, I just saw that on your feed on Facebook. So that was this gravesite you were talking about was on her old property.
Yeah, the gravesite was about 300 yards from where she spent, well, I guess it was her grandmother's house, and she spent several years growing up there. But it's I don't think it's related to that because it's much older than, you know, yeah, right.
Well, that's neat. And getting back just a little bit to the kids, I think you have a unique quality in telling the stories. You'd mentioned that earlier, but even just there in that little tidbit about how you saw the way the outline of the topography and the one rock and so forth, and I think that's what attracts people or what's made you successful there is your way to tell the story and explain it in a way that people can understand and relate to. Anyhow, that's just my observation, but obviously you've had success with it, and that's important. It's definitely a gift.
Yeah.
But I know with kids, that's important, the storytelling. We, to digress just briefly, we're doing a thing called Read Berkeley, and I was actually in the second grade today doing their book orders. And these kids, I mean, the books are, you know, tarantula versus, you know, a different kind of spider, or this whale versus this whale, or so forth, and then a bunch of treasure hunting books and that type of stuff. They just absolutely get enthused, and seeing that enthusiasm, I can only imagine that they're seeing some of the stuff you're digging or the suspense you're building and what we're going to dig up when we get here or under this water or under this rock or whatever. I can see why they're really attracted to that.
Yeah, yeah. Be honest with you, I don't know how it happened with me. You know, because I've always been very shy, you know. Turn the camera on, I would hide before I started YouTube. But yeah, I'm not sure how it happened or how I tell the stories or why people are interested in how I'm telling the stories, but it just seems to work. I mean, people, you know, seem to like it for some reason. I don't really understand it.
So how did you?
That's always the way it is, isn't it?
How did you get started? Did you just take this up as a hobby, or did you have any sort of background before you started and became
started
interested?
What?
Well, I guess the you know, metal detecting and the digs and things of that sort. I mean, when you went to school, were you inspired by anybody? Did you study history? Was there anything that kind of led you to that prior?
Well, I think in the very beginning, as a very young child, I mean, I was always interested in finding stuff. Always, as long as I can remember, been interested in history as well. You know, I was metal detecting, you know, when I was in the early teens, you know, I had my first metal detector over 40 years ago. So I've always been really interested in finding stuff. I don't know why. I mean, I have siblings that are not. I've always been interested in history. I have siblings that do not have any interest. Now, I went to Shepherd here. I study archaeology with Professor Hulse. I did, you know, all the field work and lab work and stuff. So I have a pretty good background in understanding what I'm seeing now. You know, I had friends here at Shepherd that, you know, I really kind of helped develop my interest in the Civil War stuff here. Jeff Bowers, you know, Digger.
Digger,
yeah. Who could forget Jeff, right? He still, you know, lives down the road. I haven't talked to him in a couple of years. I need to stop by and see him. But, yeah, him and his dad really, it kind of re-sparked a lot of my interest in metal detecting. And So, yeah, there's been a lot of people that have helped me appreciate the history and learn about the history. But I think some of it I was just born with. You know, nature versus nurture, you have some of it.
You know, one of the things that obviously we're a travel group. And did you ever imagine, though, when you were 14, 16 years old, where the only places that you were doing it were in the field out by the farm, and now this has given you an opportunity to travel pretty much all over the world?
Yeah. 10 years ago, I would never have dreamed I would be doing what I'm doing now. I have traveled, you know, prior to 10 years ago, I'd do a little bit of traveling up and down the coast, you know, But now, I mean, I'm traveling worldwide, you know, metal detecting, and I'm doing a lot of the social media stuff because of my metal detecting in my YouTube channel. I, you know, I go all over now, and I never dreamed I'd be doing that. I never, 20 years ago, I could not have imagined myself being able to do anything like that, just because I was so shy, you know. It's amazing how people change. Where has it taken
you?
I don't know why.
Where has it taken you?
I know you can't. What do you mean? If, like, for travels?
Yeah.
Oh, you know, I tell you, you know, I do a lot of stuff with, you know, different, especially metal detecting manufacturers. You know, I do some work with them, travel different places. But I kind of got hooked up with Garrett Metal Detectors, mm-hmm. and they are just super, super great people, great company. And, yeah, they're sent me all over the place. Mm-hmm. I've been, you know, just within the last year or two, I've been, you know, to Russia, Italy, England. I spent 3 weeks in Australia, you know, last summer. I just go all over.
So are they identifying these places for you to go, or are you doing that? How do you decide together where to go?
Well, typically what they would do is they would have some type of social, you know, event, some type of, like, metal detecting rally, okay, that might have 1,000 people attending. And I would go with them, generally speaking, and I'd just be, like, you know, signing autographs, taking, you know, pictures with people and stuff like that. I mean, it's really easy work for me. You know what I mean? So we do that for a couple of days. But then they would have other things lined up with other metal detecting people and stuff that we might go for a week or 2 weeks and just go metal detecting. And I'm doing my YouTube videos, naturally, and, you know, they're doing their own thing. And so I don't really have to do any work. I'm not lining stuff up.
It makes it so easy. As far as planning your travel.
Yeah, as far as planning those kind of, yeah, that kind of travel. I don't really have to do, I don't have to do anything. Do they everything's help, done for me.
They
it's
help
really
you
simple.
With taking care of the airfare and the hotels, everything, all that stuff, so you don't have to worry about going through and planning all of that.
No, and it's so, so nice to not have to worry about that. Now, I do travel on my own, but most of that is, like, within the United States. Mm-hmm. I like to drive, and I like to camp. I will take off for 3 weeks. You know, this is what I do. I do YouTube. So I can take off for 3 weeks. That's as long as my wife will let me go, though. Yeah, at the end of 3 weeks, she's calling me. But, yeah, I love to just get in the truck, and, you know, I sleep in the truck. I never sleep in hotels. You know, I'll put my boat on top. I'll just take off, and I will sometimes have an idea where I'm going. You know, maybe something I want to do in Arizona. So I'll go to Arizona and do it. But then I'm just kind of free to do what I want to do. I've got a huge fan base from YouTube, so I'm able to, you know, kind of get in touch with people and go to see some places that I would never be able to find on my own. But generally speaking, when I travel, I like to just kind of do my own thing, seat of the pants, you know, have maybe one goal out there and just let it go from there and just take 3 weeks and just be by myself, sleeping in the truck at night, listening to the coyotes in the desert. I just love it all.
So with that spontaneity, awesome. What are some things that, obviously things come up that are unexpected, but what are some of the wilder things that wasn't obviously on the itinerary that came up and was like, whoa, did that just happen?
Well, yeah, I mean, all kinds of weird things. I mean, spending the night in an Anasazi cliff dwelling because I didn't plan very well and didn't have a flashlight and couldn't hike off the mountain, you know. I've done stuff like that where you're just up there and all of a sudden it's like, you have to just spend the night there because it's too dangerous to try to come off the mountain. And I've done stuff like that. And I mean, it's stupid. You know what I mean? I just poor planning, but it's spontaneity. You know, I love that.
Right.
You know, the hike just took a lot longer than I thought it would.
So when you're in the cave on a night like that, are you posting to YouTube?
No. I'm just trying to survive. You know what I mean? I don't want anyone to know that I'm just trying to survive.
There's a whole nother show out there that's based on that. You know, if you video yourself surviving, maybe you could rival that show.
I was going to say, we need to hook you up with Bear Grylls. The two of you together would probably make a heck of a show.
Yeah, I've had some close calls. I've done stupid stuff, but I try to be safe because, you know, usually I'm by myself. So I do try to be safe. And part of that is not trying to hike off the mountain in the middle of the night, you know, and just basically sitting down with your back against the wall and hope a tarantula doesn't bite you or something, you know.
Do you think you'd travel globally if relic hunting didn't take you traveling? Do you think you would at all? Or
yeah, I mean, I've done a lot of traveling in my life that is not related to metal detecting or my YouTube stuff. You know, I've traveled all over. But I found that when I can combine the two, the love of travel, because I do like to travel, with a reason, a real reason to be there, something I want to learn about and can actually physically touch, you know. I kind of have gravitated toward that kind of travel now. Whereas before it was, you know, let's travel to, you know, France and see some museums and walk around and have a good time. That's great. But now it's like I want to have a reason. There's got to be a reason to be there. Mm-hmm. And it's just fallen in my lap that with this metal detecting stuff and, you know, my YouTube fame, that I'm able to do it so easily now. It's just right. Lovely. Yeah. Lovely.
So do you have a favorite place to go places that you like to go back to?
I love Arizona.
Type of place?
You know, I tell you, I go to Southern Arizona. That's my favorite place, I think. Southern Arizona and the I just love the desert out there. When I'm by myself, if I need to get away, that's where I go.
What types of things are you finding there?
You know, I don't do as much metal detecting when I'm out there on my own for my own reasons. I love the Apache history and the Apache Wars history. And I will go out there and I'll search for these sites that I have researched where things happen, bad things, you know, massacres or battles or surrenders. And I try to find these places that are usually, you know, they're not marked. I mean, you just basically have something that a soldier wrote, you know, 100 years ago describing the canyon they were in. And I try to find these places and just go there. I mean, not metal detecting, and just try to find it and go there and just sit there. Maybe read the dispatches from that era and the letters that were written from that area. That is my comfort. I really like doing that.
Wow, that's neat.
So I have a question for you. So for the average traveler or a person who's just running around, some of the things that I like about watching your channel is those kind of just unique discoveries or something to look for that I never even thought about. Do you have any suggestions for somebody who is in a new place or going to a new place for the first time? How would they or what should they do to try to find something that'd be unique or interesting to try to find out? Do you have any suggestions?
Yeah, it's real simple. Just take your blinders off. Everyone walks around with these blinders, or as they say in jolly old England, blinkers, you know, like the things the horses used to wear. You know, you put on the horses so you can't see.
Yeah.
Take those off and look around. I mean, even if you're not looking for artifacts or something like that, there's so much more. And you guys know this because you're travelers. You know, you have taken those off, and you're looking. You're not just looking for the museum that you want to go visit. You're looking all around. You're looking in the back alleys. You're looking here. You're looking there. It's the same type of thing. Exactly what you guys are doing. Take them off. For me, if you want to find things, you know, look at the ground. Spend time looking at the ground. There's so much stuff underfoot. You know, when you're at one of those museums, just wander over to the, you know, the flower beds and stuff if you can see dirt and just look. You'll see all kinds of stuff.
Crazy,
you know. It's just right. Taking, you know, just taking those blinkers off or blinders off, and just be observant. Just look, you know, make yourself look.
I tend to do that from a photography perspective because I'm always trying to get an angle that somebody's not gotten before, which is hard to do. You very rarely do it, but you look for it, and it does that. And that does that for me.
And
I know what you mean.
Is the exact same thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, I mean, you can go to the Eiffel Tower and get that shot that everyone's gotten, or you, like you say, you can take those blinders off and go outside of the box and, you know, try to make it a little bit different. It's the same thing with treasure hunting and the type of stuff that I do. You know, you just have to, you know, look for something a little different, just not the straight and narrow.
Does that, with people that are, have become into metal detecting. I know my brother-in-law has gotten into it in the last 4 or 5 years, and he's a fan of yours, him and his best friend. And they're just local. They're from around here, from Jefferson County, and go to different places. And so, in fact, they've even gone in Tony's backyard here in Shepherdstown and found some coins and all. But I'm always...
He asked.
Yeah, like you're both, Tony and Brian live in town.
Okay. Yeah. See, I should have done some negotiating here.
You have the largest lot in town, don't you?
Both Tony and I have one of the larger lots in the town. Of
he's all excited.
We need to talk, man.
Yeah, actually, come back out here and hit the town run. You might find a bunch of stuff.
That's what he was talking
checked
about.
It out. Yeah, I was down there looking at it on the way in.
But I think it's neat that even though these people have metal detect, or maybe you've been there, other metal detectors have been there in the past, still going over these same types of grounds, just like Shepherdstown. I mean, I'm sure you've maybe not obviously all the lots here, but still there's stuff to be found even after all these years. And I don't know what the numbers are of people doing it, but I think it's pretty cool. And maybe it's a little bit to what you're saying, just take the blinders off and look in a few new places. But what's your experience there? Why do you think, you know, even if somebody's been there, they're still finding other stuff that wasn't uncovered before?
Well, you know, unfortunately, once something is found, it's gone. It doesn't grow back. But, you know, with metal detecting anyway, you know, metal detecting, the technology changes with the metal detectors. So the ones we use today are so much better than the ones we used 20 years ago. But also, it's the individual. I think the individual knowing how to use the metal detector, the individual who is thinking outside of the box, you know, and is will look slightly differently than people in the past have looked, listens a little bit differently. So it's I think it's your life experiences that allows you to find stuff even when you and are in places that people have looked before many, many times. I mean, I think it's an accumulative thing, you know, with your life experiences and being able to find stuff. And traveling is the same way. I mean, the more you travel, the more you know how to learn, the more you know how to enjoy it.
Yeah, I just planned a trip for 10 to Italy and had to cancel everything. So, boy, have I learned a lot.
But hey, that's a shame.
You're postponing.
Really is.
Postponing. We are.
Yeah.
Because you do want to go back probably in the fall if, you know.
If they're still in Italy.
Yeah. I hope so.
They will be.
That kind of leads me. Your wife travel with you much? Does she ever travel with you?
No, not too much. Not on the trips that I go on, like the, you know, metal detecting and YouTube stuff. No, she really hasn't.
Did you take her to Italy?
No. She's been, you know, it's like, I've been.
Oh, okay. I thought maybe she, it's one of, she had a favorite place or one to go back to or.
You know, I don't know. I mean, you know, our last trip, we were in Europe, not too many, a couple years ago, and we went all, it was a kind of a metal detecting trip. One of my fans actually invited me over. And, you know, we went all over Europe. You know, we were, you know, from England to France, Germany, Italy, and everything in between. We covered it all. And that was just a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, she does travel with me some, but not a lot.
That southern Italy landscape is a lot like Arizona.
It's dry.
And Greece. I don't know if you've ever been to Greece.
Never
but
been.
It was so arid in the, you know, we're in Santorini. They get, 40-some inches of rain a year. It's very arid, weird climate, and right out in the middle of the sea. You know what I mean? So,
yeah.
It's just.
The world's a strange place.
It is.
Isn't
it? It is a strange place.
It's not what you expect all the time, is Mm-mm. it? I just, you know, I was in Australia and I was expecting desert everywhere, but it was not desert where I was. It was, you know, rainforest, tropical, you know, crazy stuff.
I lived in Nevada. I lived in Vegas for about 9 months, but what I do, you and I are a lot alike. I love to drive. I could drive for 15 hours. I really can, no problem. Just let me use the restroom, and I'll get back in the car. I could drive. It's never bothered me. And I like it when I can go flat out. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
You've always liked to drive fast.
Yeah, but I discovered Nevada that way. Mm-hmm. Nevada's a beautiful state, and all people think of is Vegas. And I'm like, I love Vegas, and Vegas is great. But, man, there's a lot to that place. It's a gorgeous state, very mountainous. Get out and see it. You know, and it's not just a flat desert like everybody thinks yeah, you know, a sand day desert and dunes. It's not what it
is. Yeah, there is a lot. No, I was spending a fair amount of time out there, like looking for meteorites and stuff like that and camping. And yeah, I like Nevada.
I brought some of those black rocks back from Nevada and they're in my, just because people don't realize that. And they're so different. And you never, and I brought some back with me and they sit in my yard. And everybody else walking by doesn't know what it is.
Right.
But I know what it is. Right. If you want me to tell you, I'll tell you, but I'll probably bore you to death. Right, Bo?
Yeah.
So, Bo, have you found some meteorites in your hunting?
Yeah. I like to search for meteorites, and I found, a fair number in, Nevada, with a metal detector, and I've also eyeballed, found with just my eyes, freshly fallen meteorites.
How fresh?
Which is so, they were on the ground for a week.
You're kidding. How do you know that?
Well, there's a whole group of people that look for meteorites, and they watch the news, and if there's a fireball on the news, the people go to try to find them because a lot of times those things explode in the air, and they fall to the ground. And there was I was fortunate that one of my friends local was part of a group that found where they fell. And so it was in West Texas, the town of West. And that was, probably been 8 or 10 years now. But, yeah, so I go out to drive out to West Texas and, just walking around on these cow pastures and stuff, and you could find these little black rocks that were meteorites that were in space, a week before.
Right.
And you pick them up, and you can smell them, and they smell like asphalt, like burning asphalt.
Wow.
And, I guess that's this scent of space. It's so cool that here you picked this thing up that's been in space for billions of years flying around,
right?
And now all of a sudden it smells like asphalt.
Yeah,
so I get I got half a dozen of them or so.
All right, so yeah. I remember we're going back at least probably 10 years ago now and talking about all the stuff that you had collected over the previous 20-30 years, and you were talking about running out of space for things at that point. So it's been a decade later, and you've gone to how many countries, and you're doing this all the time now. So where the hell do you keep everything?
Yeah, that has been a problem. I have I had a museum set up in my basement, big basement, and I like to put everything on display that I can, because a lot of people, they have it in boxes and stuff like that. You can't really enjoy it. You can't enjoy it as the owner, and it's really hard to show people when you're pulling out boxes, and it gets very boring. But so I put everything on display. You walk into my relic room, and the walls are covered with stuff. There's just stuff everywhere. That's the way it was. Right now it isn't that way, because I did a TV show 2 summers ago, and I put everything away in storage because I was kind of freaked out that somebody would come rob me. And
right?
I haven't put it back out yet because I got to redo it because I have too much stuff. They're like, have to make an addition on the house. So I don't know what to do.
So, out of all of these things that you've found over the year, do you have some favorites?
I do. My wife.
But
they use it. It's always, people always ask, what's your favorite find?
As long as you don't say that, your favorite relic.
Yeah, I know. Find. I always get disappointed. What's your favorite relic? I can't say it. I was listening to you.
I'm glad I asked the question.
Yeah, I'm glad too, because I was listening. I was like, my ears perked up.
So other than your wife, can you tell us about a few of your favorite finds?
I think my favorite finds, I don't really have one that I can point to.
What comes to mind?
I like ID discs, the dog tags of the Civil War era. Okay, because the soldiers during the Civil War did not have dog tags. They had to buy different things that they could inscribe their names on and their unit and whatnot if they wanted to. They didn't have to. I like finding those. I think that's the holy grail for me, is to find those things. Because when you get the soldier's name, and often these are really beautiful artifacts, and they'll have their name on it, their hometown, the battles they fought in, because the soldiers wanted all that. But you can look up those soldiers. There's great information online, Smithsonian, I guess. You can look them up, and you get all kinds of information about where they, what they did, who they were. When their widows filed for their pensions, and they almost always did, after soldiers might have died 20 years after the war, There's reams of letters and stuff from their people they served with, from friends and family, and you learn so much about this guy. And here you are holding his ID disc, you know, so you can put a really good story together, and it's a good history. So that's kind of one of my favorite things. You know, I found some really cool artifacts, and they're cool, but you can't really make the story. You can't tell the story, you know, unless you can, you know, attribute it to a person. And when you can do that, it makes it special, I think.
And every find kind of has its own story. To me, like every photograph I see, there's a story behind a lot of them. I would assume it's the same type of thing with relics.
Well, absolutely. You know, you find so many different things, and, you know, everything that's out there tells, there is a story behind it. Mm-hmm. You know, a crow's foot battery. I found this thing in a creek over near Pawpaw or something, you know. It's a weird-looking thing that was in the creek. I actually found it and left it. A couple years later, I found it again. I said, yeah, I'll pick this thing. I'll take it home with me this time. So I took it home, and I posted a picture or something, and it turns out it's a thing called a crow's foot battery. It's made out of zinc, and you know what? It looks kind of like a crow's foot, but that is how they made electricity to run the telegraphs on the railroad. Back during the Civil War era.
Oh,
you think about it. They had telegraphs. No, right. Tap, 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 tap. Well, how did they have the electricity for that? How did they make electricity back then? Well, they had these zinc things that they would stick down in a jar of copper sulfate, and it made a slight electrical charge.
Hmm.
And it would slowly dissolve over time. I have some that are almost completely dissolved. But, yeah, a stupid little artifact that I literally threw back one time. What a great story. That's one of my favorite things. It's one of the things I pick up when people are looking at my collection that I can talk about. You know, what do you think this is? You know, type
right.
thing. No one has a clue. And most people, including myself, never really thought about how did they make electricity to run those things back in 1863.
Right.
You know? But that's how they did it.
Well, they just plugged something in the wall.
I know, right?
Well, they kind of did.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was a crow's foot battery and copper sulfate in a jar.
And you didn't know that until you found that piece.
Not
and
a clue.
Discovered it, right?
Not a clue.
That's
right?
Really good.
Yeah.
That's neat.
Well, it helps to have a nice, good network of fans and people that you work with that you can throw that picture up there and they're like, I know what that is.
Yeah. I mean, the internet has changed everything, you know. Almost everything I find, I can identify really quick if I don't know what it is. I only have one or two things that I haven't been able to identify yet. But, yeah, it's changed everything, even as far as, you know, researching. You know, there's so much. You know, every library in the world pretty much is in your computer now or on your phone. So it's just changed everything as far as researching how to places to look, where to go, where, you know, places you want to travel. Isn't it so much different now than it was 10, mm-hmm. 20 years ago.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I like to complain about technology, but I hate to complain about it because it's gotten me, you know, it helped me find my family in Italy. Without GPS, I never would have found it. And, you know, things like that. I'm traveling through southern Italy alone, you know, just by GPS, hoping to find this place. And without that technology, I never would have found it. Well, I might have on a map, but it wouldn't have been as easy. You just listen to her tell you where to go, you know?
I know, I love that. I've almost ended up in a pond or a river once or twice.
I love how a lot of times you listen to it so blindly. I think we were on a trip, and it says, take this next exit. And I'm looking over there and seeing the traffic backed up. But I'm like, it says to go that way. Okay. Like, really?
And you just, stop. Oh, and, like, and you can't go backwards.
Oh, right?
Yeah. So, anything dangerous?
Oh, yeah. Snakes in Arizona.
Artifacts that you found. Anything that you've...
Yeah, sure. You know, I like to look for artillery shells. You know, boom, boom stuff, you know. Civil War stuff is black powder, so it's not really that dangerous unless you're, you know, mess with it certain ways. But, yeah, I found, like, World War II, World War I artillery shells.
Mm.
Close to here. I found one under the bridge, right over there.
Wow.
You know, Shepherdstown, where
crazy.
Someone pitched it over the side. And, you know, the World War I, World War II bombs can be somewhat unstable. So those are dangerous. And you got to really be careful with those. And people find them all the time because people throw stuff in the river. They want to get rid of it, they throw it in the river.
When you find one of those, what do you, how do you handle it, or what do you do with it after the fact? Do you take it somewhere, or what makes it safe later?
Well, no, I will not. Like World War One, World War Two stuff, no, I pretty much leave in the bottom of the river.
Yeah, leave them there.
It's on display in his basement.
Typically, I will hide it in such a manner that it will be very difficult to find from someone, even with a metal detector. You know,
gotcha.
So, how do you know if it's safe to even pick up or to move? Have you learned over the years just looking at something whether or not you feel like you can move it?
Yeah. I mean, you can move most anything. You know, it's not like in the movies where you breathe on it and explodes. It's not like that. But yeah, there are some dangers, and I don't like put them in my car to take them someplace to hide them or anything. I don't do that. Like I said, Civil War stuff, which is what I'm really looking for and what I normally am finding, is not dangerous to move at all. I mean,
you find most of it in water, don't you?
Well, I find a lot of it in the water. Yeah, because people throw stuff in the water, you know. When they want to get rid of something, they pitch it in the river.
Out of sight, out of mind.
Exactly. And I find lots of guns and, you know, artillery shells and stuff like that in the river.
So are there places, I mean, do you have to ask permission for many of the places that you go to? Are you ahead of time requesting permission, or do you know if you need to?
Yeah. Well, on land, you always have to have permission, unless you're in a place that just allows metal detecting, public property, which a lot of public property doesn't. Any federal property in the United States, whether it be, you know, battlefield or just BLM land, out west, national forest, you can't metal detect on it. If the federal government owns it, you cannot take any artifacts off of the property that's older than 50 years. So you find a penny from 1963, you can't take it. I mean, that literally is a felony if you pick that penny up and put it in your pocket, 1963 or whatever it is now. So if you're on land, you pretty much have to have permission from the landowner, which is generally speaking pretty easy to do, as long as you're not in an area where there's tons of people metal detecting, like battlefield, like right on the battlefield areas like that. It can be a little bit dicey getting permission. In the rivers, all the waterways in the United States are owned by the various states. So every state has their own rules. Some states allow it, some states don't. Some states you have to have permits, some you don't. So you do have to know that.
And so I assume, you know, nowadays that's pretty easy to find out. You know, you can...
It's not as easy to find out as you think it would be, but it's becoming easier because there's so many people going in the water now. Back when I first started, I mean, no one looked in the water. You know, when I first started metal detecting in the water, there was a small group of people that did it, but not many. But because of YouTube and me and others finding stuff, I mean, there's a lot of people going in the rivers now. So it's a little easier to find that information, you know, what state you have to have permits, you know, what state you don't. But, I mean, the rules are kind of archaic because they're geared primarily toward the recovery of artifacts from shipwrecks. That's how the archaeologists got all these laws passed, was the shipwrecks and protecting shipwrecks and stuff like that. But it translates all the way back to the rivers and the streams, you know, any public water. Now, not all water is public, naturally. There are, like, the Pecan Creek, which is nearby. In West Virginia, it's public, but when you get into Virginia, it turns to private. So you have to have permission from the landowners, not the state.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Now, have you ever donated anything that you have found to or lent to a museum or anything? Anything that you thought, hey, this ought to be in this county's, you know, museum or something?
Yeah, you know, that's a really good question, and I have. But most museums now don't want they don't want something on loan. And I've had a museum, local museums, when I've tried to loan things so that people can look at them, say, no, we either want it or not. You know, either we get it's ours or not. We're not going to be your storage facility, is what they actually told me. And, you know, this is with some really cool artifacts, Williamsport, Maryland, that tied into the history of the town. And I thought it was fantastic. I didn't really want to give it to them just yet. But, you know, they basically said, go away, you know, go away. But you have to be really careful with museums because museums sell the stuff that you give them. There's no law against them selling stuff. So, you know, if they have if they have something that they love and it's on display for 2 years and then someone new comes in decides they don't want to display that anymore, they sell it.
Yeah,
and they buy copiers or whatever they're buying.
Raise money.
Yeah, so it's good that it's out there for people to see, but generally speaking, my advice is, you know, if you found it and you're happy to give the value away to the museum, fine. But, you know, there are plenty of collectors out there that love the stuff that we find, that will cherish the things that we find, and you could sell it to them if you want to. I have never sold anything, but you could sell it to them or keep it in your estate like I have right now, my entire collection. I still have it. You know, if something happens to me, my wife can sell it and it stays in the estate. So, the proceeds of all this work that I've done over the years will stay in my estate for my wife or for my nieces and things like that. And it's not just given away for people to buy copiers or get a pay raise in a museum. I'm not saying that giving stuff to museums is necessarily a bad thing, but you really have to do your homework because they sell. I mean, I've seen museums. There was a museum in Gettysburg. Tons of people donated the collections to recently, you know, over the years. They closed, sold everything at auction. I have a good friend down in Alabama that has some of the most awesome relics you have ever seen that were donated to museums when the old-time relic hunter died, and they immediately turned around and sold them. And he bought most of the collection. It cost him a fortune. Gosh. But it's in his basement now.
He found it and bought it.
Well, no. Oh. His, old-time relic hunters found it.
Okay.
And donated it to museums. Their estate donated it to the museum. And the museum turned around and said, we're going to sell these things, We don't want to display them. And a friend of mine, was an older guy who knew them and knew the value of these things, bought like most of the collection. But that money left the estate, That could have gone to the grandkids or whatever. And it went to the museum. And, somebody got a raise probably. That's where the money went. So, but I have things that need to be. I do have some things that need to be in museums. But it has to be the right one.
Sure. Now that's good advice. I know here at the Jefferson County Museum, my grandfather was a big antique gun collector. But way before he passed in like 1988, he had John Brown's gun, John Brown's handcuffs for when he went to the gallows. And they're still on loan in the family's name, in his name, at the Jefferson County Museum. So I sort of knew about that, but those are some good things to know about because obviously that was done a while back and policies change and that type of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, and it's wonderful that they did that and that they have them on display down there because those are priceless artifacts that tell a great story and are tied right into this area, the history of this area. But you do have to be cautious.
Sure.
Things disappear, too, in museums.
Yeah.
Up the road in Virginia a couple years ago, they had a museum. They asked if I could put some stuff on display. And they were real excited about some of the stuff that I had found in the area. And I said, well, what kind of security do you have? None. They got robbed like a year ago.
Mm. Oh, wow.
And everyone that donated stuff is gone.
Wow.
The stuff's gone. So you do have to be cautious.
Sure.
Yeah, I didn't give them anything when they said they had no security.
Right, yeah.
It's like, forget it.
Right.
Do you have an actual count of cannonballs, bullets? You don't keep a running count, do you?
I don't keep a running count, but I have photographs of everything I've ever found.
Right.
And videos of, most of the stuff I found within the past 10 years. So I do have photographs of everything. I document where I find the stuff. Everything I have I have certain ways I document. I don't want to tell everybody, but, so if something got stolen, I could tell the police what to look for on certain artifacts. Mm-hmm. I try to document everything I find, and if everything I find from like one location, I'll keep in a separate thing from that location. I think that's very important. In the beginning, I didn't do that. Most people don't do that. I mean, they just find stuff, and oh, this is cool. It ends up in the big bucket full of stuff, and
right.
You lose the provenance, and that's important to know where it came from. You know, I think it's really important to keep that. If you can, it's tough when you have a lot of little things, but I think it's important to at least try.
Now, I remember a story, and I don't remember if this is prior to your YouTube or whatever, and Jim Reed and Terry Hall were the ones telling me about it, or somehow we got talking about it, and you had actually gone to, like, England and had come across some, like, an old Roman village or something and found a bunch of Roman coins and that type of stuff. I might be butchering the story because I did not check with them recently, and I'm testing a very faulty memory here. But that sounded familiar. I was kind of in wow at the time. I was like, wow, I mean, Bo's really gotten onto something there. I'm not sure how he got into that and then fell upon this, but it is any of that story somewhat true? And if so, can you elaborate a little bit on it?
Well, you know, I think I know the story that you're talking about. Now, I go to England a lot. I'm metal detected over there many, you know, dozens and dozens of times. Found lots of Roman artifacts and, you know, Celtic artifacts. But I think the story you're referring to is on one of my trips there, I actually found a Roman villa, which was, you know, the main house to an estate that no one knew was there. I mean, the archaeologists didn't know it was there. And, you know, I just happened to find it in the field because they used lead pipes, and I got a big signal down there and dug it up, and there was these lead pipes under, you know, right at the plow line, and kind of dug around a little bit, and that's what it turned out to be, an unknown Roman, you know, villa, which was kind of cool, you know.
Yeah.
But you know, the archaeologists would, you know, came in there afterwards, and I'm not exactly sure what happened, but I'm sure they did that, you know, pieces of floor tile, and it was really awesome. But yeah, those things are out there, and people find them all the time. Just unknown things like that.
Now, in a situation like that where you're on foreign soil, are you able to keep any of the spoils of what you find, or how does that work? Are there any rules, laws?
Yeah, every country has different rules. The UK, I say England all the time, but it's the UK. Well, no, actually it is England, because the UK has different rules, different countries over there. But like in England, when we go over, and you know, it's a really big destination for travelers, for metal detecting people go to England. I mean, there's thousands of people go over there on tours and whatnot to look for stuff. Yeah, they have a really good setup over there where you get to keep everything unless the museum wants it. Okay, if like one of the museums wants an artifact, and it has to be a really special artifact because they have to buy it from you. Okay, so say you find some gold artifact that the museum wants, they have to have it appraised, and you get to keep half of the money, and the landowner gets half of the money. But that doesn't happen very often. For the most part, the Roman coins and the Celtic coins, and I found some really cool, like, gold coins from 50 BC, Celtic coins, wow. You know, a lot of them. And you get to keep it all.
Nice.
And it has to go through an export process, and it can take a month or two, but you get to keep it all.
Now, is what along those lines, and I'm assuming it's going to be close, what is the oldest artifact that you can identify as far as a date or something?
I have a Celtic coin that was 200 BC.
Wow.
Now, I have found other
artifacts.
In England.
Okay.
Yeah, in England, naturally.
Yeah.
Now, I found artifacts that are much, you know, even older than that. Of course, here you can find artifacts that are 10,000 years old, 12,000, you know, Indian artifacts, stone artifacts. But as far as like a coin or something that the archaeologist could date, 200 BC.
Legible, you can.
It doesn't say 200 BC.
I know it doesn't say that, but does it have writing?
Yeah,
on it?
Well, it has. Yeah, it has figures on it.
Okay,
so you know they know what reign, you know, who was in, Odin king in the Celtic times, I guess. But yeah, they can figure. They know about when it was made. They could say it was made between 200 and 220 BC. Yeah.
So, what? Do you have any place coming up of a big trip or a place you're going to go or get scheduled that you want to?
Yeah, you know, it's really sad because I had a trip planned to Italy and Russia coming up. But with the COVID-19 scare, I'm not going to go. I don't know. I was going to go with, you know, the Garrett Metal Detecting Company. I don't know if they're still going to go or not. I'll try to go. But I told them I don't want to risk it because – boy, I tell you, being packed on those airlines nowadays is so, I get sick like half the time, it seems, you know. I've been lucky the last three or four times I haven't, but boy, I tell you, it seems like I always come down with something after that trip. And it's just, it's a little scary right now. You know, a month from now, who knows, but I'm not going to go.
Well, then a follow-up, do you have you have like this place that you would really love to go that you haven't been to yet, or a place that you would like to?
No. You know why? I'm going to tell you, because I can go. I can go.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I don't have any place. Except Antarctica. I guess Antarctica. I like to go look for meteorites in Antarctica.
That's a little different. Terry Hall wants to go to Antarctica, yeah, so I guess you won't be.
I want to look for meteorites there, though. It's got to be a reason, meteorites. But, they, you know, it's a scientific thing, and they don't let you do that. So,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. The rules for
everything. Hey, you didn't ask me about my TV show.
Oh, we need to do that.
Yeah, so, okay. So,
hey, what about your TV show?
Yeah, my TV show. I did a TV show called River Hunters two summers ago.
I was going to ask,
because
I was going to ask, how was it working with the History Channel? So, boom, there you go.
Yeah, well, it wasn't actually, I did work with the History Channel, but, you know, it was a production company that was working. Well, I loved it, absolutely loved it. It was a great show, had a lot of fun. I got Giardia. During that time,
really?
Lost 23 pounds,
holy
couldn't
kamoli.
Eat for weeks. I was so sick. And,
wow.
Yeah, I was like, when I came home, I was gone for 2 months. My wife didn't even recognize me standing at the airport. I was so gaunt and old looking, you know. But it was fun. It was such a good time. And we didn't do it the last year, but they're still going to try to do it again this year. So, you know, we don't know just yet, but hopefully that will
so
work
what was
out.
The name of that?
Is River Hunters.
River Hunters.
Yeah, it was on the History UK, History UK.
Okay. And yeah. How many, did you do a number of episodes?
We did eight.
Eight episodes.
Eight, back-to-back, solid. Mm-hmm. And it was so hard. The water is so cold over there. Of course, I was sick.
What bodies of water were you in? Just some popular
gosh,
ones.
Rivers, lots of, I mean, it was so
You're
neat.
You're on the Thames, too, weren't you?
We didn't actually do the... Well, we might have done the upper, yeah. But again, I don't have to plan anything. They do all the research and stuff, and you know, we just show up. So, but we, you know, right below castles, places you would never be able to metal detect. You know, we're finding I guess one of the better finds was we found a bronze axe. I don't know, 4,000 years, 7,000 years. I don't even remember anymore. You know, in the river, but the thing was pristine.
Wow.
Really?
Yeah. No. Yeah. Just beautiful stuff over there.
I bet that made for good production value. I'm sure they made it so it. And I didn't see the episode, but we found something good. You know, I don't know how they said it.
Yeah,
but
of course.
Brought it up.
That's how they do it. Yeah, that's how they do it. But you know, everything we found was donated to the local museums and stuff. So it was fun, and we always had archaeologists with us. So. They would actually metal detect with us, but it was a really good time, and I hope we do it again this summer.
Oh, that'd be great. Yeah.
That's great. And another was there another TV show, or is this the River Hunters? That was the one.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That was the one. I've only done the one TV show. Mm-hmm. You know, try to do a lot of them, but the networks are really picky. You know, they're really picky as to what there's got to be something special about it. You know.
Well, how did that come about?
I have to tell you a story, huh?
I was saying, how did that come about, the fact that you end up with the TV show?
River Hunters? Uh-huh. YouTube. Yeah, the production
So
people.
They reached out to you and said,
You know, but I get contacted a lot, you know, sometimes it depends, but yeah, I get contacted a lot. In fact, I shot a pilot for another show just recently. I got to tell you this story. I guess I can tell the story now since the network didn't pick it up. But anyway, so it was in New York City, right? And on the, can't remember what side. It was not the New York, not the city side, but across the river. And there's a canal there called the Gowanus Canal. It's supposed to be the most polluted canal in America. The most polluted waterway in America is Gowanus Canal. And that's where they dumped, you know, the mob would dump the bodies. It's just a disgusting place. Well, anyway, part of the show was that, you know, we're in there looking around with metal detectors. And I was in there, and one of the guys there had a big magnet, right? And he got stuck on a bulkhead. So I said, oh, I'll go get that, you know. So I jumped in this canoe, and I went to get this this magnet that was stuck, and it wouldn't come loose. I mean, I'm pounding it with a hammer and, then, you know, just trying to pry it loose. And, of course, naturally, it eventually came loose, right? But it rolled me in the canoe, and I went underwater.
In that water.
In this place, Gowanus Canal. I mean, oh, my God, it was so gross. But I was lucky. I was so lucky because the water actually wasn't that bad that day, okay? That night, it rained. And we had to go back to the Gowanus Canal. to shoot some more because it was a couple days there. And because it had rained, they decided that they could, like, let all the raw sewage out. Okay.
Oh, my.
So they had what they called the purge, where they opened the gates and all the raw sewage. So we're, like, canoeing, you know, having a good time. And they hadn't opened the gates yet, right? And then all of a sudden, this wall of crap hits us. I mean, it's, like, literally, I mean, just feces, logs, and just, like, condoms. And it stunk so bad.
Oh, wow.
Oh, it was hideous. And I thought to myself, boy, I tell you, if I had fallen in the water that day, yeah. I mean, it would eat me alive.
Right.
You know, it would eat me alive.
You need to come back with a lot worse than what would you have before.
Right? I know. I was so thankful that I fell in when it wasn't too bad.
No, you looked at that guy and said, sorry.
I had, like, everything. It had, you know, like, gonorrhea in there. Yeah. So, like, everything. It's just horrible.
I'd be like, buddy, sorry, your magnet's lost. It's done.
Bo, whatever you do, don't roll this boat.
Yeah, iguana's gonna... That's horrible. Crazy. Anyway, it was fun, though. I had a good time.
So how would a beginner get started? Do you have a recommendation for, you know, some basic equipment and maybe what to do to if you want to go out and explore a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. Watch my videos.
And where do you find them?
No, really, seriously.
Where do you find your videos?
Yeah, my Aqua Chigger on YouTube.
Okay.
Type in Aqua Chigger and there I'll be.
There you go.
But anyway, yeah, you know, when I first started, you didn't have that. But now you do. Now you can go to YouTube and you can see videos. You can learn so much about how to do things and where to look. And so, yeah, start there.
I call YouTube the greatest reference the world ever created.
I use it all the time for, you know, when I'm like want to work on my truck and stuff.
Look, I'm not a reader, man. I'm a watcher. I learn by watching and seeing things. I learn through these. Sorry, I'm different. So, you know, I like to watch it. Yeah. And if I can watch a video, because I like to cook. Cooking's the same way. Right. You know, it's the greatest reference the world ever created. Yeah. It really is.
Yeah, yeah, so if you want to get into exploring and metallotechnia, yeah, jump on YouTube and watch some of the videos, and you'll learn a lot just, you know, really quickly. It won't take you years.
Right.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Good piece of advice.
Awesome. Yeah.
Well, what do you think? That's
that was quite an interview, today. Yeah. Yeah.
Anything
I mean,
we left
we're
out,
wrapping up already?
Whoa, anything we left out there?
Oh, we can go.
What else did you
want? Well, no, I'm done. We are going to record an adult version after this for our subscribers.
A bonus cover.
Yeah. Bonus.
Yeah,
I'm sorry. I said
adult
cover.
Get the shot glasses
cover.
Out, right?
Yeah, bonus coverage. We're gonna have, I have something I want to say in bonus coverage too. I got a little something I want to tease
bonus.
You about.
Bonus.
So we'll just go into bonus coverage.
Well,
now.
Well, let's tidy this up a little bit.
Oh shoot, getting ahead of myself.
Before we get into bonus coverage, first of all, I want to thank Bo for coming over the Aqua Chigger. Do you want to give one last shout out to your sponsors, your YouTube channel, your TVs, real quick to let our listeners hear again?
You know, I want to thank you guys for having me. This has been a lot of fun, and I really appreciate you inviting me. And again, my YouTube is, you know, Aqua Chigger, and Facebook is Aqua Chigger. You know, jump over there and like, subscribe, and all that follow stuff, you know, whatever they say nowadays.
Awesome, yeah. Awesome. Well, we certainly appreciate you coming in, taking your time out of your busy schedule. This will wrap up this week's podcast of Friends of Carry On. Obviously, you can catch us at www.friendsofcarryon.com or at Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube at friendsofcarryon.com. Our next podcast, we're going to do another interview, and this one is with John Hemingway, which is Ernest Hemingway's grandson. We've become friends with him in Pamplona, Spain. He just wrote a new book called Bacchanalia. Hopefully, I said that right. I really enjoyed it, and we're looking forward to talking to him on our next podcast. So stay tuned then. And for those who have subscribed to the website, stay tuned for bonus coverage.
Bye, everybody.
Arrivederci.
Thanks, Bo.
Thank you.
Be sure to join the friends next week for another great discussion. Don't forget to subscribe if you haven't already. You can also find the friends and other content at www.friendsatcarryon.com. Or check us out on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook by searching Friends That Carry On. Thanks again for joining us, and don't forget to carry on, friends.